We've got a really full breakfast this morning. I think only one person hasn't turned up, which I think has got to be a new record for breakfast here. And now I'd like to hand over to Richard Excel of Excel Designs, who's our breakfast sponsor this month. Richard?
Thanks very much. My name is Richard Excel, and we're your breakfast sponsor today. Company is Excel Design, which I'll tell you about in just a moment. It's really difficult not to slip into presenting mode because I usually share it with Carol here. So I shall try not to slip into announcing the events. But as a company, we're very, very delighted and pleased to be sponsoring the Chamber again. This is our second year of sponsoring the breakfast for 3 months. The Chamber's given an awful lot to us. We've made loads of new contacts, met an awful lot of nice people, and I think it's testament to the Chamber today to see a fully booked breakfast and a lot of new faces here as well, which is really good, as well as the familiar faces. Excel Design are a design and branding company. We specialise in looking at company identities, producing anything from logo design through to brochure and printed materials, website design, email marketing, and also exhibition and display materials. But we very much focus on your branding, helping you to get your messaging right when you're talking to your target audiences and therefore driving up your new customers and your sales. To have a look at a little bit of our work, we produce the Chamber quarterly for them. So there's some of those on the tables there, along with some of our pens, which seem to have disappeared, which is a good thing. If there are any pens left, do use them to tick the events that you'd like to come to and book in advance, because as you can see, it does sell out very, very fast here. We have a couple of offers that we're doing. They're on the Chamber website. We are doing 1 year's free hosting for any newly commissioned website that any Chamber member takes up with us. We're also doing an offer on pop-up banner stands, the very same things here for your exhibition and displays. As the season has hit us pretty quickly, I believe there's a Brighton and Hove show on later this month. I know there's people from Let's Do Business, another show which we've booked a stand at, and there's the Eco Technology show coming up. If you want to take up an offer with us, we'll do your design and produce your pop-up banner stand for £100 only, and that's delivered to your door. Come and have a chat if you'd like to find out more about that. And just finally, we're doing a business card draw, which is quite unashamedly to get your email address to put on our newsletter. You will be able to receive that on a monthly basis. I think they've been around with the business card draw. One of you lucky people could be going home with a breaky bottom today. If you don't know what that is, you'll find out if you win. So good luck to that person. And last of all but not least, we've decided this month to donate £1 for every business card that comes into the pot over the next 3 breakfasts to the Martlets Hospice. It's something that we fully believe in and support. So thank you very much for your time. I'm going to hand back to Carol.
Now it's my great pleasure to introduce Duncan Baker Brown, who's going to be our guest speaker this morning.
Thank you, Carol. Well, firstly, I'd like to say thank you to Carluccio's for a really lovely breakfast. I wish I hadn't gone for the cook one, though, because I'm half asleep now and I need to be really going for it. Well done for everybody else that turned up as well. Very early morning. I have been asked to talk about me for a bit, so just bear with me. I was born in Essex. I'm an Essex boy. I'm not from around here. And I was lucky enough to be brought up near a farm, right next to a farm. I was brought up on the edges of Epping Forest. And you may or may not know this place, but it's the first bit of countryside beyond the east end of London. So Epping Forest actually starts in Walthamstow. And my family are all from Walthamstow. Both sets of grandparents were born there. And if you did quite well, made a bit of money, you went east and you went and lived in Essex. And Essex is very well known for having a lot of people with a bit of money. We didn't have a bit of money. We didn't have too much money at all. But my mother set up business in Essex. She moved onto about an acre of land next to this farm where my grandparents had bought a house. And my grandfather worked for ED&F Mann, who are the city brokers, Mann's as in the Mann Booker Prize. And so he bought a lovely lodge, Victorian lodge house, and it had about an acre of land, and my mother built a house on that land as well. So my mother featured quite highly in my life, obviously, but as someone that did stuff. She built our house, she ran the business. Her business was actually, she was mad on dogs. She bred dogs and had boarding kennels, and she didn't make a lot of money because dog breeders that earn a lot of money get rid of their dogs after about 6 years old because they're not having lots of puppies anymore. But we just had about 40 dogs, most of which were just pets, really. And so she wondered why she never made any money. She did make a bit of money, but she just knew how to spend it. Not least on my brother. I've got a twin brother, my younger brother and I, because she sent us all to prep school. So we all went to Woodford Green Prep and had a good education. But it was fees. So how on earth she did three lots of fees, I don't know. But she grafted. And she was always quite a sort of positive figure in my life. I can remember being about 12 years old writing an essay about her. And I did see that she's got a great sense of humour. She's got totally different politics to me. She's a true blue Tory. But she used to canvass for the Tory party wearing a red jumper and things like that. So she used to slightly get it all wrong. But amazing figurehead. She did, however, she made us everything. So I can remember being constantly aware that we might be broke and might not be able to go to the prep school anymore. So I think that did have an effect on me because I'm constantly concerned about balancing the books. And I'm always renegotiating an overdraft with a bank manager and luckily hardly ever having to use it. And they're saying, why are you worried about this? And so I think that's one slightly negative thing. I haven't spoken about my father. My father never earned a sod. He got through life finding people like my mother who could earn money. And but he was the man with all the stories. He was the man who, his CV would say, Olympic and national judo coach, which he was. Dog breeder, which he was. My mum and dad met at Crufts. My father always used to say she got best in show. Apparently, I don't remember that. But they did meet at Crufts. But my father was also a spiritual healer. And so he could heal you. He saw ghosts all the time, spirits all the time. Stuff happened. It was just weird stuff all the time. And he was full of stories. So one of his best stories was the fact that in the Munich air disaster, when the Busby Babes football team crashed, his story is that he told all the dead players that they were dead. Because apparently if you die quickly, your spirit doesn't know it's dead. So he'd come out with this stuff, and my God, here, 40 years later, I'm repeating it to you. And I can remember as a... I'm saying that because it was the joy of the story was amazing. So he had come up with all these amazing stories. I'm direct descendant of Queen Victoria as well because the name's Baker Brown, but we're actually Browns. My grandfather, who I think my father learnt all his skills from, was a Walthamstow barrow boy, made good, and also an illusionist. And told my father that we were the direct descendants of John Brown, who was Queen Victoria's gilly and she supposedly had a baby with. And I could spend the next 20 minutes talking about that. But I remember as a teenager starting to repeat some of these stories that had gone down well at junior school. And people walking away, losing credibility. So have I still got an audience? But my grandfather, if you've got a minute, do check out YouTube and tap in Harry Baker Brown. There is a great Pathé News clip of the amazing Harry Baker Brown, my grandfather, doing amazing, so-called amazing. And when you look at them, they're not actually that amazing. There's one thing that he's doing which is amazing. They filmed it. I think it must have been a slow news day. They put dough on his eyes. They wrapped a cloth around his face. And then he's filmed nailing two bits of wood together, and apparently this is an amazing trick. And then he's filmed riding a bicycle around some cones like that, and he's going like this. So, yeah, anyway, so the bullshit factor in my family is quite high. My mother was just as bad, though, actually, thinking on it, because she said that we were related to artist Constable and Sergeant. And I just think we had some police people in our family, actually. Why we're not multimillionaires with all these amazing links, I don't know. But my father, as I said, could tell a story. but he did do stuff as well. He was always on these judo tours. So I can remember, especially as a junior school attendee, that my father went and he met the King and Queen of Norway. And he also toured South Africa when you shouldn't have done, so he was blacklisted. But he took black judo players with him. He wasn't racist at all, but he actually didn't give a damn. He didn't like people telling him what to do. And that was, for me, quite a strong lesson. I can remember him being in quite significant situations with people, politicians or whatever, and he'd be very confident, and he'd be his own person. He was definitely his own man. And as a teenager, one of the proudest moments I had, which was a bit strange, was when he dressed down Brian Jacks in front of me. And anyone who's my sort of age may know who Brian Jacks was. Brian Jacks was Olympic bronze medalist judo player. My father coached him, but he was also world superstar. And if anyone remembers the superstars, he was better than Kevin Keegan. He ate a lot of oranges, did a lot of press-ups, but he was world superstar. And my dad told him off in front of me. And he didn't do it in front of me. It was at Crystal Palace Sports Centre. And I thought, oh, God, yeah. My dad's... I know he's a character. I know he doesn't earn a penny. I know my mum does all the hard work. But he has a laugh, doesn't he? And so in situations I've come across where I found myself in a situation, I'm thinking, try and use your dad's sort of sense of humour, because that's got me quite a long way. But my mother, as I said, she drew me down to a sort of sense of reality. And I can remember, this bit of paper has got going out the window now. But I've written these sort of six epiphanies. I've had six. And the first one was when we were walking with my mother up in what we called Rabbit Meadow, this lovely meadow, and we walked to the top of it. I was about 7 or 8, and I said to my looked over there, I said, Mum, what's that? She said, that's London. And I could see the city of London, the actual city. And I thought I lived in a wilderness. I thought I lived in this lovely, wild place, as far as I'm concerned, lovely countryside, but it was the first bit of green space outside London. So from that day on, I was really aware of the sort of potential battle between natural resources, the natural world, and human development. And that has really steered me and influenced me from that early age. I can remember my mother saying one thing, feels like the same time, it probably wasn't. She was saying, one day there'll just be national parks, everything else will be sprawl, urban sprawl. And that just really shocked me. And then within a few years of that, the M11 was built and went ploughing through some countryside and a little place called Passenford Bridge, where my grandfather and grandmother had met in a rural work, is now a big roundabout. And that sort of thing really affected me. The next thing that affected me was going to stay at my Uncle Jeffrey's house. He was rich. We weren't. He was an architect. And I didn't really know what architects did. But he was an architect in the 60s, 70s, 80s, but in the 60s especially, where architects could make some money. And he'd set up his own practice in Kensington, in London. And we were staying at his lovely house at a place called Burnham Beeches, northwest of London. And this lovely, lovely, amazing house called Cadbrook. And he wasn't there. He'd let us house share. And I just remember seeing this photograph in his living room. And I thought, what on earth is that? And I said to my mother, what's that? And she said, that's Jeffrey's office. And what it was a sort of plate glass lower window in a mews in South Kensington, a plate glass lower window, this 1960s beautiful Italian furniture in the... It looked like a furniture showroom, but it was the reception to his office. And then three stories of copper-clad facade. And I just never seen anything like it. I lived on a farm. And I just thought, God, wow, you can design stuff and you can affect the environment and change it if you don't like what it is. So from that age, I was in this sort of conflict. I either wanted to be a gamekeeper, an explorer, or an architect. And I ran with that for a number of years. And then I would say that the things I was really good at, I did get very good at judo. I was in the national team. I had quite a good coach, Not that he coached me very often. That was a good thing. He wasn't our coach. We went and did it somewhere else. But that gave me a lot of confidence, and I was very good at drawing, and that gave me a lot of confidence. My mother let me paint on our walls in our house, which is quite, and I mean, I wouldn't let my daughter do it now. But so I remember my father coming home once, and there was this probably not that good black horse on the wall of the living room, and he was like, "What's come on here?" And he was quite cross. But I had my mother gave me, and my father in a different way, gave me the sort of the balls to do that sort of thing. And by the time I was in my teens, I was being an artist. I still wanted to go to art school, though, so I had a place at art school to do a foundation course. And then my mother and father split up. And my mother went down to Devon, and my father went off somewhere else. And I was left in Essex without the ability to get a grant. And so my Uncle Geoffrey came to the rescue, and I went and worked for him for 5 years. And he had his office was in Holland Park by then, and then Notting Hill Gate. So I worked for him, and he convinced me to study part-time. That's what he'd done. And so by the time I got my degree, I'd got 4 years working experience. And it was pretty good, because I was in competition with other architects who'd got no work experience when they had to come out after their degree and then do 1 year apprenticeship, as it were. And that was amazing. He didn't pay me very much. He was a difficult character. And luckily, after about 5 years, I met some other people, other architects, and went and worked for lots of other architects. And that was all the way through the 80s. And by the end of the 80s, I was actually a bit disenchanted with the world of architecture. And I was working on two projects, I remember. I was just saying this to someone else. I was working on the Thompson Twins flat. Anyone remember the Thompson Twins? There's a guy over here that remembers everything. You're good value for money. You must be at least 32. Anyway, Thompson Twins flat. Lovely, great. And John Ritblatt isn't in the room, is he? No, the chairman of British Land. I wish he was in the room. I wouldn't tell this story, though. But we just did his £100,000 kitchen, or his wife's 100, which is about as big as that one, in 1988. And I just thought, oh, this is bonkers. What? I don't want to be doing this. And I was thinking, no, I'm going to go and work for Greenpeace. And that was in the back of my mind. And then I thought, no, I'll finish off my architectural education, but I'll do the next bit full time. And I went and got 4 interviews in colleges in London. And all 4 interviewers were people I knew. So I thought, oh my God, the London architecture scene is a bit small. And the last interview I got was with a guy called David Dunster, who I still see as an external examiner for University of Brighton. He doesn't remember me, not from 1988 anyway. Anyway, he was interviewing me and he had his feet on his table, his desk, and he was chomping on a big cigar. And he said, "Duncan, darling, you're just the sort of person we want here at the Bartlett," which is, by the way, probably the best school of architecture. And I said, "David, are you going to open my portfolio?" And he said, "Anyone that's worked for Tim can come here. I know that you've got a good grounding. Come here." And I just said, I don't want to go to the bar for Tim. And Tim was a part-time tutor at the university. So I thought, I know, I'll go somewhere where I know no one. Ends of the earth. I'll go to the ends of the earth. So I phoned up the School of Architecture in Brighton. That's the end of the line, I tell you. I was thinking about Hastings, but I thought, no, it's going to be Brighton. So I phoned, and they said, "Who are you, for a start? You know, hadn't heard of me," which is good. And this guy, David Robson, who's now a good friend of mine, he said, "Well, you could come here, a full-time course. We don't do any part-time stuff. Part-time's not good because you don't really learn. You'll know nothing about the history and theory of design or architecture because you've just been working your ass off in an office and then doing the rest as night school." And I thought, well, yeah, that's one description. But we were actually very motivated as part-time students. And by the way, it's the best decision I ever made to go part-time for my degree. The people I met, 5 or 6 of them, all have their own practices now, all very successful. Project architect for Tate Modern was my best man. Project architect for the Le Barn Centre in Deptford, and a Sterling Prize winning building, also a good friend of mine. It was amazing to study part-time. When I was only 18, a lot of people on the course were up into their 30s. You know, I had someone from the punk group Crass who was studying architecture with me. Well done, Toby. Oh, he's not from Crass, but he could have been. and you know, someone else was in a housing co-op. Someone else had been in the, you know, been in the student rights in Paris in '68. Really had been there. Photographer. I studied with these people. Now, if I'd done it full time, I would have been with a bunch of 18-year-old kids doing the same thing. So go part time. I think that's a good idea. Came down here though, and was told that, you know, maybe I wouldn't be that good. I was very motivated. Knocked out the course in 2 years. Now, the great thing about Brighton is they allowed me to study what I wanted to study, which was sustainable design. I wanted to link the green concerns I got with the design concerns I've got. And I was able to do it here. And because it was a postgraduate course, I wrote a dissertation around the whole subject. Did very well. That's good. But the great thing was, and I didn't realize this until I came out, I was suddenly an expert. Me and my now partner, Ian, we were experts in the so-called experts in the world of sustainable design. And it was 1991. And we knew a lot more than other architects did because we had the freedom to study this thing for 2 years. And we also knew what we didn't know. By 1993, I was working in London but living in Lewes, commuting. And my partner now, Ian and I, Ian phoned me up and said, there's a competition to design the house of the future. And he said, it's a green house of the future. So, you know, it's right up our street. I think his note was like, you know, this is ours, we'll win this. We did. We won it. And 1993 was a bit like now. It was a recession, not a lot going on. And we won this competition and we got a huge amount of publicity. We were on all the broadsheets, some of the red tops, all the broadsheets. We were on BBC News, we were on Tomorrow's World, the whole thing. And I was like, oh, wow, this is good. We got this thing built in 1994. We got involved in the whole sort of PR, politics stuff. It was really interesting because the chairman of the Federation of Petroleum Suppliers came to visit our house, which was open for six weeks. Him and his Daily Telegraph mate wrote a story that said that our house was so green, gone out on such a green limb that it was structurally unsound. Meanwhile, it's got 10,000 visitors a week. So, you know, and it was really good grounding from that point of view. And really, I do believe it was not such a thing as bad PR. We were all over the place. It was great. And we were able to set up our practice on the back of that. We also got invited to teach at Brighton as well. So since 1994, I've taught part-time in the Faculty of Art, where there's the School of Architecture. So now I'll get on to here. Or just before I do that, actually, there's one other thing I want to mention. Because we were allowed to research via the university, we actually were able to experiment and come up with do a lot of blue sky thinking. And that has led to us getting work. So, for example, in the late 90s, we were asked to put together a design team to enter a competition for one of the Millennium Villages, and this was the Greenwich Millennium Village. And at the first stage, it was just us and another firm of architects in Camden called HTA. And they didn't know what sustainable design was. So it was, BBM, can you just tell us what that is, please? Deal with that bit of it. Because John Prescott's interested in it now, so can you deal with that bit? And we did. And we got through to the semi-final. And then there was this conversation we had in Camden at HTA's offices, which was, right, well, the other semi-finalists are Richard Rogers, Norman Foster, et cetera, et cetera. No offense, Duncan, but no one's heard of you lot. And it was only two of us anyway. So I said, well, actually, I've just been on a study tour with the University of Brighton of Austria around Vienna. And an architect who's from the 50s and 60s and 70s called Ralph Erskine. He's Mr. Placemaker. He's the only person that can sell contemporary design to communities, so-called communities. I said, why don't we work with him? And they said, oh, isn't he dead? I said, no, he's not. I've just seen loads of stuff he's built. He's 84. He's 84, but he's not dead. Anyway, this guy, he's English, but practiced in Sweden. He have the life. He practiced on a narrow boat. He took his narrow boat to wherever the job was. That's the way. Why I wasn't inspired to do that, I don't know. But anyway, that was the way to do it. He's such a cool dude. We won the competition, but we had this mad three-month period of doing this competition. My office was open for 24 hours for, 6 weeks. So I had a day shift and a night shift. One weekend, we had... I'm almost there. One weekend... Train... one weekend, I had this amazing... Ralph Erskine, you can see why he was still practicing at 84. By the way, he said no initially, and then his doctor said, no, you'll probably extend your life if you get involved, actually. And he was such a dude. One weekend, we were charged. We were actually drawing the whole thing up. So Ralph was coming up. He was a renowned master planner. So he came up with this amazing master plan. Immediately looked like a medieval city. Amazing. But he just did felt tip sketches. And we had to turn that into CAD computer drawings in plan, section, and elevation. And I sent out this memo on a Saturday night. Because Ralph was AWOL. He was at a cocktail party. And so we're English and we're right list doing 24-hour shifts, and Ralph's in Sweden just chilling and just sending out. At 9:15 this evening, we are designing in the style of Ralph Erskine, because we had a Monday deadline to show the scheme in 3D. And I just got a student that happened to be working for me, and I said, look, there's a Ralph Erskine book, bit of that. And he did these drawings overnight, and I just came, it was like a bit of magic. I went to bed, woke up next morning, and in my office were these drawings, these Erskine-esque elevations, and that was the scheme that won the competition. That is the scheme that I built. And I never did tell that student, because he only did that one night. That's a lie. So I've been lucky enough to be involved in good stuff, but research has been the thing. Combining research with practice. And now, since the year 2000 till now, I've been involved in a lot of projects locally, a lot of built projects, a lot of residential stuff, but also some nice stuff in Hastings Media Centre, things like that. But the thing that I'm feeling now is we've got such an unusual opportunity here in Brighton. Brighton is known for its green thinking, actually, nationally. Brighton is an unusual city. It's half a city by the sea. But Brighton has a green MP and a green council. We have the ear of the council and the MP and the city. And I really think our opportunity to do something about it from the point of view of practicing our business in a low-carbon way. Now, I'm not going to tell you how to do that, but I'm just going to end with one big thing, which I just think there's so many definitions of what green is, what sustainable development is. If everybody in the world existed like we do in this room today, you would need 4.5 planets of stuff, resources. I don't care about CO2 emissions, whether there's global warming or whatever. I'm not that bothered about that. What I'm bothered about is the fact that there isn't enough stuff for us to carry on the way we are. So what we have to do in the UK is reduce our consumption of stuff, whatever it is, in whatever practice we do, whatever we do in our day-to-day lives, look at how to reduce the consumption of stuff by 3/4. If you do that, then we're a single planet society and we can't actually do any more. Meanwhile, there's no point in us relying on plundering the rest of the planet, because by the way, while we're sitting here, China are buying it up, and so are India, and so are Brazil, so we don't have the resources that we used to. We do not have the connections anymore. So what we've got to do anyway, for a number of different reasons, is to reduce the amount of stuff. And that's what we do in practice. We look at how to build, do retrofit projects or build projects without creating so much waste. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Duncan. That was really interesting. It sounds like you had an amazing childhood, by the way. Did anyone have any questions for Duncan? Yeah?
Sorry. Can I expand on that? Just a little example. The graduate students at the University of Brighton last summer, for the first time ever, they built a temporary pavilion, to show their work in. They'd never done it before. And the pavilion was built in the courtyard at Grand Parade just over there, and it was made from a little bit of waste from a new American Express building. And there is a huge amount of... what they think is of waste, we think of as walls or ceilings or whatever it is. there's so much waste in the construction industry. When we were building lots of stuff up until 2008, on average, a construction site would throw away 20% of the stuff that arrives on site. So what we were able to do as an industry was convince our clients to build, for every five houses they build, to throw one into landfill. So that's quite a clever thing to do, isn't it? Actually, we're just, you know, we're that wasteful. So really, if you start thinking, hang on, that's costing money. So if you start using, reducing the amount that you consume, but also in terms of waste, there's lots of stuff out there that you can reuse. I mean, you can think of buildings as waste. But what at the moment, I said this the other day, I'm accidentally in the industry of demolishing good buildings because of VAT. If you retrofit a building that isn't listed, you've got VAT at 20%. It costs maybe between £5,000 and £10,000 to demolish a house. £10,000 is your seven-bedroom house. VAT on the retrofit of a house, which might be £250,000 project or more, you can see how much money, you know, immediately it's easier to demolish. So we've got a client who's got a bigger house than that. The VAT bill's £350,000. It's $10,000 to demolish this big house. But that is bonkers. However, on a more sort of everyday level, in terms of the materials that I specify, nearly all of the insulation materials that I specify are waste materials, whether it's wool, cotton, hemp, plastic, whatever it is, it's all old recycled material, stuff that would have been burnt. So, yeah, again, the idea that there's no such thing as waste just makes you question what you're using at the beginning of the line, as it were, and what you're going to throw away there. Because what you might want to throw away, other people might want to use. And there are networks developing for people. I think that's the great thing, is that there's the largest construction industry show now in Europe is EcoBuild. And that's at Excel in March. And a few years ago, you know, it's just the same old products. I was getting really bored with it. But then I realized the thing that was interesting were the networks. And that's the interesting thing about being part of the chamber as well, is all the networks, all the things that are coming up. And that's the stuff that's going to mean that, you know, I don't need this microphone anymore. Should I throw it away or give it to the person who needs it? And that's what you need, is networks.
Thanks, Duncan. I'm really pleased to be supporting two great business shows coming up in the city. We've got Let's Do Business Show.